Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host. Today, I'm speaking with Yujit, an ST6 trainee from the West Midlands, and Kate Sylvester, an ex-ophthalmologist and healthcare systems engineer from Warwick. Thank you both so much for joining me today to talk about redesigning the hospital eye service. It's a really interesting topic, and even before COVID, I think there's been a real need all over the country to consider how we change the way we see patients, because ophthalmology, as we all know, has been designated as the busiest outpatient specialty. And things only get different with COVID because we've got that whole layer of complexity where we have even more patients to see because of the backlog during COVID. We're still the busiest outpatient specialty and our capacity has been completely slashed. So I think this will be a really, really interesting topic of conversation today. So starting with Yujit, you know, I know you've done a lot of work in this area already, but could I just ask you, what got you interested in this topic?
I think I've always been interested in a systems-led, engineering-based approach to solving problems in the NHS. I have a background in health informatics. I've got a master's in health informatics, which looks at the implementation of information services to improve the delivery of healthcare system. So I love looking at things from a macro perspective, almost like a helicopter view of how the different stakeholders interplay with each other to produce a given output.
And what kind of projects have you undertaken so far and what have you achieved?
So the most recent project that I undertook was trying to improve the number of patients that were in intravitreal injection clinics during the COVID pandemic. And that was done at University Hospitals Birmingham at Good Hope Hospital. So what happened was that at the height of the COVID pandemic, the intravitreal injection clinics numbers were drastically reduced to approximately 4 patients for entire morning session. So this was not very effective for the ophthalmology service, and it would definitely increase patients' waiting time because usually we'll be doing 12 to 14 intravitreal injections in the morning session. So what happened was that my consultant, Mr. Ramesh Sivaraj, asked us trainees to look at ways of increasing the number of patients in the intravitreal injection clinics. And also by doing so, we need to make sure that we adhere by the government's social distancing policy and to make sure that the patients are still safe when they come to hospital and don't catch COVID, you know, on the way back home. So that was the most recent project that I looked at. So what we did was that we looked at the system as a whole and looked at how many patients were in the system, and the system that we're talking about would be the ophthalmology clinic. So we wanted to look at how many patients can be in the system at any given point in time, and whether or not while they're waiting, they were still able to socially distance and move around the clinics in a safe way. Initially, it was quite difficult to try to think of a system-led approach to this and to do this in a methodological order, and that was how I came across Kate Sylvester's very useful and informative article on iNews looking at how to design ophthalmology services and how some of the concepts that can be used to design a project to improve this.
Yujit, that's really fascinating actually, and one of the things I think people don't always take into account is how much logic, preparation, thinking and all these kind of things that goes into designing a service, because there's so many moving parts and the failure of just one of those parts can just cause absolute chaos, and especially in a service where you're dealing with so many variables, that's really impressive. How have things turned out with your changes?
So I think first things first, we need to talk about what is systems engineering. I think looking at things from a macro perspective, you don't just look at the individual resource, such as the doctor or the nurses, and see how they can get patients through quickly through their resource, but you look at how they interact with each other. And the first thing that I did was to follow patients throughout the entire journey as soon as they touch down an ophthalmology clinic. So from the receptionist to getting their visual acuity done at the nurse's station, and then moving on to get their eye scanned at the OCT machine and then getting the intravitreal injections. So we look at the whole patient journey and what we term as a patient's dream and how they interact with all the different resources, such as the nurses, the doctors, and the OCT machines and the scanners. And we look at where the bottleneck was and what the waiting time was between getting from one resource to the other resource. And what we discovered was that actually we could increase the number of patients for the intravitreal injection clinic quite safely to 12 patients, which was almost the pre-COVID numbers, while still maintaining safe distancing and while still maintaining the sanity of all the nurses and doctors because they were not overworked.
It's really amazing. So with all that you've mentioned there in healthcare systems engineering, we're quite honoured to have Kate Sylvester with us today. And Kate, it's been really, really interesting to even hear your story before we've even pressed the record button this morning about your background, what you've done. And sorry to ask you to repeat this, but you know, for the listeners' benefit, would you mind just sharing something about your background, how you got into healthcare systems engineering and what you've done so far?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great privilege to be asked. I feel very humbled to come back in, you know, 25 years later. I guess I've always had an interest in factories. My father was a director of many companies and used to hand it off to the foreman when he went off for a board meeting if my mum was working. That stayed with me from my childhood, and all the way through my medical training, I kept thinking, this system is crazy. And eventually I got my fellowship in 1989. I got caught up in the Great Registrar cull, and that was the opportunity to me to leave and actually train as a healthcare systems engineer. Now, the profession doesn't exist, or it's just starting to exist. And I did an MBA, did operations management, because I was particularly interested in the design of the actual flow of the factory, flow of the hospital. And I then joined Lucas Engineering and Systems here in the West Midlands, a big £4 billion turnover company, 25,000 employers. And they had learnt their lesson, not being able to supply car parts to a high enough quality, but more importantly, on time to the Derby factory for Toyota and the Nissan factory for Newcastle, and had gone back to Japan to find out how the Japanese designed their systems of production. And that was then eventually written up into this discipline called Lean Thinking by Dan Jones and Jim Womack. And I was taught to be a systems engineer. I was given a set of hard boots and a hat and sent onto the production line to make actuators for the aerospace industry. I can't say much more without being shot at dawn under the Efficient Sequence Act. But that was how I learned to literally follow the piece of metal from one end of the factory to the other and make sure that none of that metal sits on the factory floor going rusty before it goes on an aeroplane with your family on holiday. And then the great opportunity arrived, long story short, back in 1999, I was asked to rejoin the health service to run the big program to look at why patients are dying of cancer. And it's not because we haven't got the best techniques and the best medicine, it was because of the delays waiting for the various steps in the process. And now, at long last, I'm back into my old discipline of ophthalmology, helping teams in many disciplines, but as you say, ophthalmology is an important one at the moment because of the volume of patients that are impacted, designing systems of care that deliver the right care on time, every time, in full, at a cost that we can afford without stressing the staff and patients. And staff stress is a very good indicator that something is horribly wrong.
That's really, really interesting. So forgetting about COVID altogether, we've mentioned just at the beginning there that ophthalmology is the busiest outpatient specialty. And I'm really curious why you think that that's happened. You know, why has there been such a need to consider service redesign in recent years, even before COVID?
Well, the interesting thing is that this discipline of good operations management is really not well taught in any management training that you'll go through. And our initial response to a queue when we see one is to say, oh, we obviously haven't got enough resource, we need resource. And I guess the analogy that my colleague Simon comes up with is to have somebody say, I've got a headache, I'll take paracetamol, the headache goes away, QED, headache was due to a lack of paracetamol. And we can see that that is just illogical. And yet we do the same. We say, oh, we've got a queue, we need more resource, we pump a waiting list initiative in, we get more resource, the queue goes away, And lo and behold, the queue comes back again because we haven't actually addressed the underlying pathology that is causing the queue. We've just addressed the symptom. And that is why we have been pumping more and more money. So the NHS budget went up from 58 billion to 117 billion in the 2000s. And yet the queues have come back. And all the time, we've got this constant problem of the belief system, which is when you've got a queue, you haven't got enough resource. And yet what it is most of the time are the policies for managing that queue. And that's something called carve out, which is a horrible pathology to understand in a system, and one that unfortunately all the policies make worse, and it causes waste. And so the mindset difference, and this is what Lucas had to learn, was the people that believe a queue is because we haven't got enough resource, we need more resource, and then the other people who look at it from the patient's perspective and see the waste and go, why are we wasting so much? And that's the different perspective that we need to think about when we're designing a system of care.
We've all worked in the NHS and we all know how sometimes it can be very, very difficult to implement change. And Ujit, you mentioned before about bottlenecks and identifying what is the bottleneck, and if we can identify that single point of obstacle, can we improve, you know, with a small intervention, can we impact a big change on the way we run our services? I personally think the answer is yes. I just wanted to maybe share a story of my own. And that was when I was an ST1 trainee in Swindon. I hope Swindon won't mind me telling this story. And I joined and there was a big impetus to type up our notes on Medisoft rather than dictating them. And personally, I've always been a huge fan of that because I'm personally a very, very quick typer, or I'd like to think so anyway. And I think, what's the point of dictating your own letters? Because if you dictate a letter, you're just creating work for a secretary to have to type up. And that then creates lots of work for lots of different people and adds delays into a system. So I thought, brilliant. But as soon as I stepped into the clinic, I noticed that they had these absolutely atrocious foam keyboards. I wonder whether listeners might be able to relate to this, but I found them awful. You can't touch type with them, you make so many mistakes, and it was almost quite entertaining to read some of my consultants' letters from Medisoft, which were just riddled with errors and being sent out to GPs. I'm not sure if they were corrected prior to being sent out, but it was quite entertaining in some ways. So I called IT and I said to them, can we not change these keyboards? These are ridiculous. And I had some responses from the IT department saying, do you not know how much these foam keyboards cost? They cost £85 each. And I thought to myself, that's crazy, because, you know, my gaming keyboard on my computer costs far less than that, and I'm fairly sure it's infinitely better. And they explained that the reason we had these keyboards was because of infection control policy. And, you know, I thought this was also crazy because we're not really becoming in that much contact with infected bodily fluids most of the time. And I didn't really see the logic in that, to be honest. So I kind of took matters into my own hands, and I went to Currys and I bought my own keyboard and I brought it in. And all of a sudden, my productivity went through the roof. The quality of my letters was much better, and the other trainees did the same. And that kind of caught on a bit. And after everybody started doing this, I thought to myself, this is just really crazy. You know, this needs to stop. And ended up getting into a small battle with the infection control team and asked them to show me the literature that they had to prove why we were, you know, undertaking this practice. And after a few heated emails backwards and forth, they kind of relented and we managed to get new keyboards for everybody. And I was able to be the hero of the day, albeit just for 1 or 2 days, and it made a real big difference. So that's probably one of my proudest achievements in ophthalmology so far. And it goes back to talking about bottlenecks, barriers for change, and all these kind of things. And when we talk about quality improvement, one of the biggest things we encounter is barriers, hurdles. You know, how can we overcome these? You know, in the NHS, sometimes there's so much bureaucracy, it's so difficult to change things. And I was wondering, you know, from both of your perspectives, you know, you've done so much work, both of you, on in healthcare improvement. What do you think are the biggest barriers, and how can you bypass these hurdles?
I think the main barrier is to get stakeholder buy-in from all the different stakeholders. I was very lucky to get the support of Mr. Ramesh Sivaraj, who was my clinical supervisor, and he was the deputy CSL of ophthalmology at that point in time. And with a good push from authority, sometimes you can get things done a little bit easier. The other thing is that whenever you start a project, it's very important to involve all the stakeholders at the very beginning, including the receptionist, the nurses, the ophthalmic technicians, the patients as well, whenever you're collecting data, so that you wouldn't just be, you know, like somebody with a clipboard intruding on their personal space and trying to tell them what they've done right, what they've done wrong, and then to come in a few weeks later with your report saying that, okay, this is how we should do things. One of the things that I've learned from doing the Foundation of Improvement Science in Healthcare course, which we have not talked about before, but Kate mentioned this person called Simon, who is Simon Dodds, is one of the vascular surgeons who is also a healthcare systems engineer, was that there's this very useful thing called the Niggle chart. So with the Niggle chart, you get all the stakeholders involved and then you ask them, what are the things that they think are going on well at the moment? What are the things that they think are not going on so well at the moment, and how do we get to where we want to be, the ideal scenario where everything runs perfectly in clinic. So I think getting people involved right at the start and really listening to people on the ground will actually make a project run more smoothly and also get more buy-in at the end when you present your results and when you want to implement changes.
I completely concur with that, and I think one of the lessons we've learned is that you have to design, think of a system as a set of fractals. So you start with the smallest unit of a fractal, which is one individual. So it might be one individual working in their own consulting room, like I was as an SHO in Cheltenham, where I redesigned the way that we were doing the pre-op assessments by putting the patient in the middle and then spinning them around on their chair so they went from one machine to the next machine without moving. And my productivity went up dramatically, and I didn't have little old ladies tripping over in the dark. So that's an example of the smallest fractal. And then the next fractal is the unit that we call the circle of control. And that involves the people who come into direct contact with the patients. That includes the receptionist, it includes the nurses, it includes the doctors, it includes the optometrists, it includes the technicians. And you sit down and you map through what that process looks like from the patient's perspective. Now, that's quite tricky. So if you can get a patient to tell you, it's fabulous. And there are a number of times when I sit mapping clinics and I have a little old chap sitting next to me say, about time too, love, somebody doing a time and motion study. We did that when I was on the shop floor at Rolls Royce. And they know, you know, they say they watch it going on thinking, can't they just see how much useless work they're doing? So that's the first circle, this circle of control. Then outside that are the people who don't really understand the work. They don't touch the patient. They don't actually do the work. But they are the circle of influence. They make policies that can dramatically influence the way that work is done. Your squishy board is a very good example of a policy that's been implemented with all good intention, but it's made an absolute muck up of the production line. And then finally, outside that, we have the circle of concern. And these are people who are responsible and, in theory, carry the cost of the system, not only in terms of the actual financial cost, but the litigation cost for how things go. And they often have absolutely no understanding of the production system. So they're very dependent on reports and policies. And have we implemented a policy for this and that? So starting with the circle of control and working your way out by demonstrating that you have made changes is important. And I think the thing I learned most from Lucas was you learn by doing. Children learn by doing. You don't give them a lesson and then get them to do it. You let them experiment. And this is this idea of a plan, do, study, act cycle, where you look at the work, you understand what could be changed, you make a little plan to change it just for one patient, see how it works, experience it, get confident, and then make more changes. And that's the critical part of this, is you learn by doing, you learn by experiencing. And unfortunately, the NHS, many of us have never experienced a beautifully running system, other than in the private sector, which often, you know, gives us this belief that we need more resource to be as nice as the private sector to work in. But as you, Jack, just demonstrated, and so Sunil, that you can make changes that reveal huge amounts of waste, and make the system more comfortable and productive and happier and a therapeutic environment.
Hmm. That's, you know, resonates completely with some of my previous experiences, and I'm sure Yujit's as well. So with your experience as an ophthalmologist and a healthcare systems engineer and working in hospitalised services to make changes, could you maybe share some examples of, you know, small changes or, you know, the lowest hanging fruits that you've made which have made big changes?
With this sort of caveat that all systems are different, so that, you know, you can't just take a change from one system and implement it in another without making the diagnosis and making sure that that change is appropriate. I think what we've discovered time after time, and UJAT's example is a really good example of that, is that when we look at these systems and we map them, and so we get the anatomy sorted out, where are the resources in the system, and then we map the flow, the physiology between them, and then we measure the time it takes for things to happen, and we understand where the constraint is, then what we find when we make that diagnosis is that 95% of the time, the constraint is a policy constraint. We've got enough resource, but we've got a rule that says, oh, you can't do this on Mondays. That only happens on Tuesdays when there's a full moon and, you know, something else has to happen. And the lowest hanging fruit are inevitably how we are scheduling the key resource in the system. So one example I can give from another ophthalmology service, this time in Colchester, is there we just mapped the process, and what we discovered was that they were putting the patients in very quickly into the system. So the cycle time was about 20 minutes, I seem to remember, and the patients would be booked every 10 minutes. So we were overloading the service to start the clinic, and then somebody put a fire break into the clinic and an hour when no patients were booked in, and then they were booked in again every 10 minutes. So this clinic inevitably overran and was crammed with people trying to get their buses home in a very, very rural environment, where we had one lady say to us, look, I have got to catch that 5:30 bus, otherwise I can't get home tonight. And that's the stress. And all we had to do was just to map this out, illustrate it with a Gantt chart, and it was fairly obvious we could book actually two more patients into the clinic if we booked them every 20 minutes, and that got rid of the queue completely. So that's the typical kind of example that we're seeing of the policies, the scheduling policies that are causing these queues.
So just one final question for both of you now, really, is what advice would you have for a listener who's interested in systems improvement or service redesign? And maybe, you know, just for everybody, you know, if anybody's working in a healthcare environment and they're noticing something that they think could be improved or changed at all, what advice would you have for them to help them to change that?
I think the first things first is to get the involvement of the stakeholders. So knowing what the problem is, that's very important. And the second step would be, even if you know what the problem is, you need to have the knowledge to be able to implement changes. And what I would thoroughly recommend is the Foundations of Improvement Science in Healthcare course, which takes about 8 to 12 hours to complete. And it's self-directed learning. So that's the first level of the course. It will introduce you to some of the concept of healthcare systems engineering. And then the next level up to being a HCSE would be to do a project. So having the knowledge first is very helpful in terms of designing a project. For example, you can't do a systematic review if you do not know how to do a methodology search to get those papers. So that's very important.
Yes, and I think the very generous thing that Simon's done is that we've tried to make sure that this training is available to everybody, and Simon's very kindly made the Foundations of Improvement Science for Healthcare, the online part of the course, free for anybody with a professional healthcare qualification. So you can just log on, put in your GMC number or your optometry college number, and you'll be given access to the programme. And that, as you say, just gives you the few understanding of the tools and techniques that are involved. And then if you want to do a more serious project, then give me a ring or get in touch with me by email. I'd be delighted to hear from you. And we can then think about what the best way is. You know, how do we limit the fractal that you address to start with? So don't try redesigning the whole of the ophthalmic service first. Start on something small with a daily niggle that you have control over, something that you have the power to change. And preferably that you can demonstrate that change making a difference to other stakeholders in that part of the system. Because as soon as somebody experiences this extraordinary calm of a beautifully flowing clinic, its emotional impact is just phenomenal, and you get more and more buy-in and confidence that the methodology works. So don't start too big. Make sure that you've got good control over the bit you want to change, and ask for help. We're here to help.
Well, thank you so much both for joining me today. That's been really, really, really interesting. And I'll make sure to actually put a link to the course in the show notes.
Lovely. Thank you, Sunil.
Thank you.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.